7.5 years after 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security still lists New York as the city most at risk of another terrorist attack, which has led New York to come up with a wide range of strategies to avoid that possibility. Newsweek's Christopher Dickey explains how, in his latest book, Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterrorism Force, the NYPD. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm delighted that it brings Christopher Dickey back to the show today. Hello.
Well, it's great to be here.
Your subtitle suggests that you think the NYPD is doing a pretty good job. Do you think the majority of New Yorkers would agree with you?
Well, I think, yes, they probably would, as a matter of fact, certainly on the question of terrorism, because there has not been another major terrorist attack in this city, and it is the world's number one target. So somebody is doing something right. I was interested in the NYPD because it seems to me that certainly since Ray Kelly came back as commissioner, they've had a very focused, very practical, very non-ideological approach to fighting against terrorism.
Now, you say that we haven't had a terrorist attack, which suggests that it's been a success. But do we know that there was a letter to the New York Times recently that argued with the Bush administration's claims that they have done an exemplary job? They said, well, we have no idea of whether anybody really was going to mount a serious attack and whether it was thwarted or not. Did they give you information when
you were
researching?
Yeah, they did. But it's not just that it's hard to prove a negative, right? It's hard to prove that there was supposed to be an attack that didn't take place. They count, I think, 6 different incidents where they know there were major plots afoot to attack New York. But their operating principle is that basically every day of every week of every year, someone is plotting an attack in New York, which sounds like an exaggeration. But one of the things I tried to do in the book is to put this in perspective. New York has been the number one terrorist target for 100 years. There have been attacks after attacks in New York City on New Yorkers, some of them horrendous. In 1920, there was an enormous bomb set off outside of the J.P. Morgan building on Wall Street and killed more than 30 people. So even before, and in the 1990s, there were a number of attacks in New York that people forget now, but were horrible things to behold at the time.
Hasn't there also been a fair amount of criticism of the NYPD's intelligence gathering here? For example, the hundreds of protesters that were rounded up before the 2004 Republican convention?
Well, that's right. And there are a lot of questions about whether that many people needed to be rounded up, whether they should have been held as long as they were held, whether they should have been held in basically an old bus depot facility where the conditions were not really very pleasant, especially, I think, for people who hadn't done anything wrong. On the other hand, the number that were rounded up were relatively few compared to a lot of cities that have held big events like that. You've got to remember it was 2004. It was only 3 years after 9/11. And one of the things that the NYPD focused on, because it really does have a sort of global view, was the whole risk of these people using what are called black bloc techniques, which can really be hugely disruptive. The battle for Seattle, for instance. I personally was in Geneva at the G8 conference there, where somebody was killed and was hugely disrupted by that kind of thing. The NYPD set out to stop that from happening, and they succeeded. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people were able to protest peacefully, and a few hundred were held, I think, under conditions that the NYPD still has to cope with in the courts.
Well, you wrote this book while you were Paris bureau chief.
Yes, and I'm
Middle
still
East
Paris
regional
bureau chief,
editor for Newsweek.
Yeah.
Before that, you were in Cairo.
Yeah.
How did you do this, and how does what we do here compare with what you've seen elsewhere?
Well, I did it because I was able to do it partly because I have an apartment here in New York. But
I'd like to have an apartment in Paris.
But yes, well, it's nice. But I was able to come back and forth fairly frequently, and I had known actually Commissioner Kelly since about 2000, when I had worked on a story when he was at the Treasury Department, and he actually is very very Francophile. He often comes to France. His wife does as well, and I think there in fact has been a lot of cross pollination between the French and the Europeans and the NYPD. As I think everybody knows, the NYPD has detectives stationed in a lot of different countries now. And that's for intelligence gathering, but it's just also for that whole cross-pollination process. How is it that the French police fight terrorism, or the British police, or the police in Tel Aviv?
And are the police in those other countries okay about having American police stationed there? And, of course, I also wonder whether the CIA is particularly happy about
The problem is usually with the FBI. The CIA is off doing its own thing. The FBI has, in most of those countries, legal attachés, legats. And in some countries, there's really been a lot of pushback by the FBI. In France, for instance, they really were not enthusiastic about the idea.
Even though we're all trying to deal with the same problem and
well,
avoid the same problem?
Well, the concern is that the French authorities will get confused. Who do they talk to? How do they talk to them? But eventually, Marc Merchan, who was the head of the field office here, the FBI field office, I think he developed a very healthy understanding of the difference in what people do. The legats are operating out of the embassy at a very high level. The NYPD detectives have a desk in France, the desk in the intelligence division of the National Police of France, and so they're literally hanging out with the cops.
Are the legats the creation of Ray Kelly or of David Cohen, the man that he brought in as his
No, the legats are FBI, and they were mainly...
Oh, I mean the New York version.
Though the New York version. Yeah, the New York version, yes, it's very much Kelly and Cohen.
Now, let's talk about Kelly for a moment. He was police commissioner under David Dinkins and mm-hmm. brought back by Mayor Bloomberg after 9/11. What had he done in the interim?
He had been at the Treasury Department. Before that, he was working with the United Nations in Haiti. And after that, he was at Bear Stearns running their security operation.
Didn't he even live downtown at the time?
He did, in Battery Park. Still has a place in Battery Park.
So he was brought in with the understanding that he was going to change the police force, mostly in terms of this counterterrorism, or were there other concerns?
I think there probably were a lot of different concerns, but certainly the priority when he came in. I mean, Bloomberg was elected right after 9/11. When Kelly took over at the beginning of 2002, it was really very much in everybody's mind. And he came in with the mission to make the NYPD a counterterrorist force that wouldn't necessarily always operate on its own, but was focused on keeping the city safe from the threat of terrorism. Before, even when Kelly was here in 93 as police commissioner, which with the first attack on the World Trade Center, there was a kind of an assumption that the feds had everything under control, that you could trust the CIA and the FBI to catch things. Well, after 9/11, we knew that wasn't true.
But hadn't we had something like a counterterrorism department during the Cold War, the so-called Red Squad or the Bureau of Special Services called BOSS? That yeah. lasted into the 1980s.
Yeah, it did, but it was a very different kind of mission. I mean, this is part of the problem that the CIA had as the Cold War ended. The kinds of skills you acquired during the Cold War were not necessarily very relevant to the kinds of skills you needed to fight terrorism.
We weren't looking for commies under every bed.
No, far from it. And in fact, one of the strengths of the NYPD was that Kelly saw very early on that you could use the diversity of the communities here and the diversity of the police force itself to create a very effective counterterrorist operation, because you had hundreds and hundreds of people who spoke other languages as their native tongues, including dozens and dozens of Arabic speakers, Dari speakers, Farsi speakers, which gave the NYPD in 2002 an asset that the CIA didn't have and that the FBI didn't have.
Was there any reluctance on the part of these recruits to go to work for the NYPD, spy on people in their own community?
Well, they weren't recruited to spy. A lot of these were already white shields, as they call them. They were already cops on the beat. It was a question of finding them. They were already part of the NYPD. And now I think, no, you don't see it as a reluctance. About 50 different countries are represented in every graduating class of the police academy.
In fact, a lot more capable of speaking foreign languages than in the CIA and the FBI, yeah. Perhaps because they don't have to be vetted in the same way?
Well, exactly. I brought this up in the Cold War context. The security clearances that are necessary for the FBI and the CIA go back to the Cold War, when you were worried about counterintelligence operations and all of that, the sort of spy-counter-spy thing. The NYPD doesn't require those kinds of security clearances.
And we don't have James Jesus Angleton working for
us. You don't have James Jesus Angleton, and you don't worry that that think of the federal bureaucracy. You have to do a background check on someone who was born and probably grew up in Alexandria, Egypt. How are you going to do that? Well, you can't. So the guy's never going to get the job. That's not the case in the NYPD.
My guest is Christopher Dickey, whose latest book is Securing the City Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. It's published by Simon & Schuster. He did more than set up this new counterterrorism group and hire David Cohn, who was a former CIA agent.
He was former head of operations for the clandestine services of the CIA. He was the spy master of the CIA in the mid-90s.
Also started buying new equipment, like surveillance helicopters?
Sure. There'd always been some of that, but he focused a lot not only on new equipment, spy-in-the-sky kind of helicopters, which I've ridden around in a few times, but also a lot of computer work so that the police would know what they had in their hands. And you've got the Real-Time Crime Center, for instance, that's got everything from public utility records to a tattoo database. They can pull it all together.
How many people were hired?
Well, actually, the number of police has declined. It goes up and down. There's about 3,000, I think, attrition a year. And in the last two or three years, it was a big problem because the salaries for rookies were so low, maybe they just weren't getting people. Now they're getting a lot of people, but as we know, the budget cuts are going to mean they're going to probably have to take about 1,000 police off the streets.
The some of the things that have been instituted make me a little uncomfortable, like haven't they stationed snipers around the Times Square area during New Year's Eve celebration?
Well, yes. The short answer is yes. They call them counter snipers because they're worried if there was somebody in one of those windows above Times Square who suddenly appeared and started behaving in a threatening manner, much less, you know, had a grenade, a Molotov cocktail, or anything like that, they need to be able to respond. Now, shooting is not the first response. There are a lot of other responses that they have at their disposal. But one of the things they do is have people in basically hidden sniper positions around Times Square.
When he took over in 2002, David Cohn said there was an intelligence division that did literally no work on terrorism. Was that?
That's true. The intelligence division, as they say, did other things, but it didn't do that.
Why? We had already experienced a number of acts of terrorism, as you pointed out.
Well, partly because of the way the police force was structured. You would have intelligence functions within, for instance, the organized crime or the narcotics divisions. The intelligence division, to some extent, was seen within the force as a kind of an escort service for VIPs. What Cohen did was to make it very, very much focused on counterterrorist activities.
You say that Commissioner Kelly is more concerned with radiological weapons than nuclear weapons.
Yes, because they're a lot easier to make. Nuclear weapons, first of all, they have who's got them? Actually, although we talk a lot in fiction about people having them, we know who has nuclear weapons, and that makes them responsible in a way that others might not be responsible for weapons that were easier to obtain. A radiological weapon, one that emits radiation but doesn't have a nuclear explosion, can be made essentially with the same kind of explosives that were used at Oklahoma City. And all you need to do is lace them with cesium or some other radioactive component.
How would you track them?
Well, you can track them because radiological weapons or nuclear weapons have a signature that shows up on a lot of this very sophisticated gear that they have in the police department. But then the other way you track these things is through intelligence operations.
Well, David Sanger of the New York Times was a guest on the show last week, and he says that we're ill-equipped to detect nuclear weapons arriving in our ports. He says that a load of bananas is more likely to trigger a reaction from one of those detectors than a dirty bomb. He said that they wouldn't even have detected the bomb that we dropped on Hiroshima.
Well, maybe not, but I think that they're out there. Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, let's think about the terrorists for a moment. We tend to think of terrorists as masterminds and capable of carrying off technological marvels.
Well, they did a pretty good job on 9/11.
With what?
They?
With box cutters, mm-hmm. Not with nuclear devices, not with sophisticated technology. That was sophisticated planning. It wasn't sophisticated technology. In fact, we've never seen any terrorists that actually had very sophisticated technology. The cult in Japan that had sarin nerve gas killed fewer people with that gas all over the subway system in Japan than they could have killed with a couple of shotguns or AK-47s. I'm not telling you that weapons of mass destruction are not a threat, but they tend to be a much greater threat in the imagination than they are in reality. Now, you certainly, the NYPD is looking to find anything they can, and sometimes with mixed results. The federal government has put a lot of money into a program called Securing the Cities, plural, and the tests that we've seen run on that suggest that some of the helicopter-borne radiation detection devices really are not very successful. But the cops down on the street were able to find the target.
In some cities in Europe, for example, in London, there are cameras all over the place.
Well, there are in lower Manhattan, too, and there will be
many?
More.
Are we just less aware there of
will
them?
You're less aware of them, and they're still being put in place. But there's what's called the Lower Manhattan Security Initiative. There are going to be about 3,000 cameras in lower Manhattan. You're not going to be able to pick your nose without somebody seeing it on a camera.
I hope they don't arrest me for doing that.
I hope not.
But that is really something quite extraordinary that we are watched that way. It makes a lot of people very uncomfortable.
Well, I think it does. I mean, in the beginning of Securing the City, the book, I'm riding around in a police helicopter, an unmarked police helicopter, and I give the detective who's operating the what looked like the controllers for a video game my address, and the camera swings over. We're miles away from the apartment building where I have my place. The camera swings over in that direction and zeroes right in on it. And it's a very disturbing feeling to be up there watching and thinking, you know, I'd rather be up here watching than down there being watched. But that said, if there are bad guys out there, and there are, I'd like the police to have the equipment to track them.
There is a photograph in the accompanying the review of your book in the New York Times that shows those cameras. Mm. And it is impressive.
It is impressive. And they also have heat-sensitive cameras where they can see, for instance, on New Year's Eve when we were flying around above various locations, if someone has been lying on a rooftop, laying wait on a rooftop at night, they will not only see that person if he's there for a while, they'll even be able to see the shadow of his heat signature if he's gone. So it's pretty dramatic stuff.
My guest is Christopher Dickey of Newsweek. He's written a book called Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD, published by Simon & Schuster. Are there other cities with similar forces? Does Los Angeles have something like this?
Los Angeles tries. Both the Los Angeles Police Department and the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department have some of these resources, but nobody's got what New York has. And there are a couple of reasons for that. The first reason is no place is the target that New York is. There's a line from Mayor Bloomberg who says, you know, you catch a terrorist with a map in his pocket, it's always going to be of New York City, not someplace else. And that's just a fact. That's a historical fact.
And that upsets a lot of New Yorkers. Many people have told me that they're always uneasy about staying here. They stay here for other reasons. But in the back of their mind is always the possibility that they're going to be in a building or that's going to be the subject of an attack, or they'll be on the Brooklyn Bridge, which many people think is the kind of symbolic place that terrorists
might go
after.
Well, at one point was directly targeted by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He wanted to go after the Brooklyn Bridge, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed being the mastermind of 9/11. There was a whole second wave that was planned by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, part of which was going to target New York City, of course.
But it's interesting that the targets instead have been London, Madrid, Mumbai. I don't know if those all are the same people.
No, they're not all the same people, although there are some sort of general connections among all of those people. And I think one of the reasons is that those wound up being easier targets.
What is Operation Sentry?
Operation Sentry is the operation through which the NYPD tries to stay connected to the other police forces in the area. There's a lot of concern that that, for instance, in Buffalo or in Patterson, you'll have a Muslim community that actually won't be as well integrated as the one in New York, won't be as well connected to society. And when you have small groups of people, especially young men who are kind of withdrawing into their own little world of anger, that's when it can get very dangerous. Would we expect those people to attack Patterson or Buffalo? No, you'd expect those people to attack New York.
But
So you want to be in touch with the police in Patterson.
Many people question just how important the NYPD's breaking of a case in which two guys
the Herald
from Brooklyn,
Square case.
Yeah.
That's a very mixed bag, that case.
Can you tell the story?
They cite it all the time. But, yeah, you basically had a kid working at a bookshop in Brooklyn, a Muslim bookshop in Brooklyn that had a lot of diatribes and propaganda in it. And he was a very angry young man. He's not standard profile. He wasn't even a Sunni Muslim. He was an Ismaili, the same group that is led by the Aga Khan. And he was clearly a troubled individual, and he hooked up with another troubled young man, and they started talking about doing terrible things. One of the people who was frequenting the bookshop was a young Bangladeshi-born man who actually was an undercover police officer and who understood these guys and understood their culture very well. And he started doing reports on them. And eventually an older Egyptian gentleman was sent in as a confidential informant. And on the basis of his testimony, the tapes and videotapes that he collected, these two guys were convicted.
A number of listeners have called in to point out that the person who was killed at the G8 meeting in Genoa was a protester who was shot by a law enforcement officer.
That's exactly right, who was shot by the law enforcement.
So there's, there's
always
that
danger.
Who was
shot by a law enforcement officer as he was about to bash in the law enforcement officer's brains with a fire extinguisher.
Uh-huh. So it was a self-defense
It was self-defense. I'm not going to make apologies for the Italian police. They did some horrible things in Genoa, but that was not one of them.
What is the NYPD doing to prevent cyber terrorism? Are there plans in place to prevent someone from hacking into our financial system?
There are, but that is not really one of the focuses of the NYPD. That is, the NYPD's work on the Internet is much more work in chat rooms and in groups where people are trying to organize over the Internet. Much more than the actual cyber threat. That's not a big part of this.
So all of those other things that we've heard in the past about poisoning the water supply or destroying the electrical grid, our communication systems, those are really pie in the sky. They would be too difficult to pull off.
I'm not saying that they're pie in the sky for the terrorists, but that's a different question than the cyber terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
What the NYPD is looking at is to try and see whether people are organizing or chatting or talking about doing those kinds of things. And obviously they focus on them and they want to find out about them.
They're more concerned, the NYPD, about our city subway system, aren't they?
Of course they are. Look at Mumbai. Look at it started with an attack on the train station. And look at Madrid. Look at London. Or look at the example in 1997. Two young Palestinians were stopped really just hours, maybe minutes, before they were going to blow themselves up on the B train under the East River. And it was really, really luck that stopped that plot.
You said that the economic crisis is going to lead to cutbacks in the police force.
Yeah.
Will it have an effect on this counterterrorism capability?
It not directly and immediately, but over time it certainly could. Basically, you can't have this kind of counterterrorism operation, especially if it's successful, especially if there's no attacks, if the crime is rising on the streets. People have to feel safe. Securing the city is about making people secure, and not only from terrorism.
And during economic crisis, crime goes up,
well,
doesn't
not,
it?
It's actually not as direct a connection as that, but Kelly makes the point often, often when I was talking to him, that crime goes up when the number of cops on the street goes down. I mean, Giuliani gets credit for all kinds of, for CompStat and all kinds of things, all of which were useful tools under Bratton and Giuliani. But what really happened was that finally the number of police on the streets rose dramatically in 94 and 95.
Is the broken window approach something that applies here as well?
Well, the broken window approach, which suggests that quality of life is a determining factor in crime, is not, I think, something that Ray Kelly really subscribes to. And frankly, the guy who designed CompStat, Jack Maple, was contemptuous of it.
Christopher Dickey will be speaking with Commissioner Kelly and taking questions tonight at 6 o'clock at the Overseas Press Club at 40 West 45th Street. Then tomorrow he'll be speaking with NPR's Dina Temple Raston at NYU Center for Law and Security. More details on our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD, is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.